Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. The Nimrod Conference for Readers and Writers takes place this Saturday at the University of Tulsa, featuring over 25 writers, poets, editors, and literary agents participating in panel discussions, writing workshops in multiple genres, critique sessions, and readings. Along with the workshops, the winners of the Nimrod Literary Awards will be featured, along with sessions by the judges of the award, poet Kim Adonizio and fiction writer Margot Lifesey. Lifesey is my guest today. The Scotland native, who now lives in the Boston area, is the author of 8 novels, a short story collection, and a book of essays, her latest, on writing, titled The Hidden Machinery. Her most recent novel is titled Mercury, which follows Donald and Viv, a long-married couple who have made compromises in their life's journey, one willingly, the other less so. Donald wanted to be an eye surgeon, but settled for being an optometrist. Viv was a talented equestrian, but settled for a career in finance. But her passion for horses was reignited by a beautiful thoroughbred named Mercury. While Donald helps others with their vision, he fails to see what's happening in his marriage, that he's losing Viv to a horse. Margot Lifesey will be featured at the conference Saturday and at the preview event, Nimrod Write Night, which will take place Friday evening at 6:30 at the Tulsa Historical Society. That event's free to the public. Margot Lifesey joins me today on Studio Tulsa. Margot Lifesey, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you, Rich. I'm delighted to speak to you.
Your most recent book is actually a series of essays on writing, The Hidden Machinery, which I like that title. So just very quickly, what is the hidden machinery in writing?
My theory is that in the books and stories we love, there is a hidden machinery at work, which it's the job of the writer to conceal and of the apprentice writer to apprehend. And in this collection of essays, I seek to explore some aspects of that hidden machinery and how we might get better at building our own machinery.
Yeah, and I think it really comes down to two little things at the very beginning where you're talking about Henry James and E.M. Forster and how they constructed their world and how it was or wasn't impacted by where they were in their own worlds.
Yes, and that's, to me, a very important part of the argument of the intersection between our personal interests and public interests. How can we make sure that the things that are so personally preoccupying are also publicly interesting? And I think James and Forster are two wonderful examples of that. They both seem to be people who often turned away from more public events, but in different ways. They were both, of course, very influenced by, in James's case, the First World War, and in Forster's case, the First World War and the Amritsar massacre in India.
And let me ask you about yourself. How do you navigate that world of your own personal interests and the world, and how you use both of them to find subjects to write about?
I should perhaps begin by saying that I am an autodidact. I did a BA at the University of York in England. I graduated shortly before my 21st birthday, and I swore never to enter a classroom again. And then, to my amazement, found myself teaching in my late 20s. But during that time, between graduation and when I re-entered a classroom, I was teaching myself to write by reading and by writing very, very badly. And I think I was one of the things I was slow to understand was that, you know, I could be hugely interested in something, but other people might actually find it quite dull, as my agent sometimes points out to me. So I'm always thinking about that question. And in my latest novel, Mercury, I explore the question of what happens when a man discovers that his wife has, without telling him, bought a gun. And obviously that in part is my response to the violence that we keep hearing about in the news.
Well, The Hidden Machinery, we'll talk about Mercury in a moment. This book uses classic texts for close reading. And this is something, as I guess you mentioned, it says, you know, you sort of were self-taught in many ways. This is how you learned to write, was going over great books in depth on a very molecular level, if you will, down to the words within a sentence to find meaning, to figure out what the writer was trying to get across.
Yes, and I think for most people who are avid readers, this doesn't come naturally, because when you start reading something, if you like it, you sort of fall through a trapdoor, if you will, into the world of the story, and you're not noticing how it's being constructed, how it's being made. So for me, it still takes rereading to figure out, well, what was Toni Morrison doing in The Bluest Eye? What was Zizi Packer doing in Drinking Coffee Elsewhere? I really need to stop and look at how those authors are creating their characters and building the arc of their plots.
In your essay, How to Tell a True Story, you categorize writing from what you would call fiction to anti-fiction. Now, that's an interesting set of terms. What do you mean by those two sets of terms?
This is one of those awkward occasions when I had to invent my own terms. I don't think anti-fiction really only makes sense in a way in the context of my essay, but I was really interested in the fact that I sometimes gave my students conflicting advice. Sometimes a student would bring me a story and I would say, oh, you don't need three children. You don't need Margaret, Jane, and Theo. Just make Margaret and Jane one person. and sometimes I would say, no, three children aren't nearly enough. Why not have five or have seven? And in one case, I was advising the student to make the story more efficient, more expedient, to have every detail matter. In other words, the classic story writing advice. And in the other case, seven children, I was advising the author to make the story messier and more lifelike, and I'm using that word in several sets of quotes, so that people reading the story would think, oh, this really happened, as we do when we start some pieces of work and as we don't when we start others.
And certain work seems to be, you're entering a world created by the writer. Another piece might seem like this came out of real life in which you just change a few details.
Exactly. And that second category, I think, is particularly slippery. It can be very persuasive when it's well done, but it can also sort of have the shortcomings of an anecdote, namely that we don't feel that urgent, dark river pulling us along as we do in the best fiction. And I think it's interesting for young writers to consider, well, how could I tell certain stories that are maybe a bit far-fetched or impossible, and one way to tell them is by making it seem more like they come out of the author's own life.
I want to ask you about the decision to write about process. Several of the writers that you quote in the book are writers that also have written about process, Francine Prose, Jane Smiley, to name two. What was it that was happening in your own writing life where you decided, hey, I want to share this, how I write about process?
I wish I could say that it was that kind of decision where I actually stopped and thought, right, I'm going to write a book called The Hidden Machinery. But in fact, it was much more haphazard. I was invited either to contribute essays or to give talks at writers' conferences about pedagogy, about craft. And the earliest essays in The Hidden Machinery, their origins date from the 1990s. And I gradually realized that through some of those essays and talks, there was a theme that I really wanted to mine and explore. And so I decided to group them around this idea of the hidden machinery.
My guest today is Margot Livesey. She's a New York Times bestselling novelist and fiction judge for Nimrod's Catherine Ann Porter Prize. She'll be the featured guest at Nimrod's Conference for Readers and Writers this Saturday at University of Tulsa. Her latest novel is titled Mercury, and her latest book is The Hidden Machinery, Essays on Writing, and she's our guest today on Studio Tulsa. Well, before we talk about Mercury a little bit, I'd like to talk about one section which sort of aligns with some of the issues you dealt with in writing Mercury, and that's in creating a character. You write, you use a series of prompts and rules to help cipher who a character is. If it's a good character, they must have a failure of vice. If it's a bad character, they have to have a redeeming quality and something that is quite outstanding about them. When creating a character, can you talk about some of those prompts and rules that you have and why you came up with those rules? Were they very helpful throughout your career?
Well, one of the things I realized shamefully late was that almost all my characters were created in the same way. They had brown hair and blue eyes, because that's what almost everyone in Scotland has. And then they either wore glasses or they didn't. And then there were two or three things they always did. They shrugged, they nodded, a couple of other gestures. And I realized, like many people actually, when they sit down to write, that I was initially creating not characters, but stereotypes, and that I needed to work harder to think how to conjure up a complicated character on the page. If it was a round character, then clearly I had more, a round character, a central character, clearly I had more space. If it was a minor character, then I'd be trying to do it very briefly. And I started again in my rereading, analyzing what made a character complicated. Why is Holger, say, in Flannery O'Connor's story, Good Country People, such an interesting and complicated character? Why is the Bible salesman who steals her wooden leg not just a one-dimensional villain?
So how did you come up with those prompts and rules? Was it just trial and experience?
It was both trial and experience with my own work and also trying to figure out what was truly helpful to the young writers I work with. I discovered that almost every craft book at some point has something about character. But I felt that sometimes those lists and suggestions felt rather formulaic. And I think part of the problem is that the first person we're writing for is really ourselves. And so we're trying to write the character onto the page for ourselves. And that makes things like, you know, what is the character's horoscope or favorite hobby or political affiliation feel like rather sort of dull suggestions, perhaps, or not helpful.
I was struck by some of the rules that you had. She said when you're creating a character that's different from you, you start with the outside in, the superficial, and then you begin to flesh that character out. But when a character is standing in for you or a doppelganger of some sort or has something very close with you, you start with their most innermost desires, their who they are on the inside, and work your way out.
Yes, and again, I think that comes out of that dual experience of writing and teaching. I realized in my own work and other people's as well that sometimes the most shadowy and least convincing characters were those first-person narrators who seemed rather close to the author, who seemed in a way almost to stand in for the author and really didn't have enough going on for them to really create them as characters. And I found following my list of prompts in inventing a fault, inventing a virtue, was particularly helpful with those characters.
By starting with who they are on the inside and then make sure you get to the outside, the superficial, the little things that might inform a reader.
Exactly. I mean, it's amazing how much we as a species do when we first meet someone. We take in so many things about a person, and just watching someone order coffee at the local cafe, you form so many impressions about them. So I often do spend time taking notes in public places and urging my students to do the same.
Well, in the case of your most recent novel, Mercury, as I understand it, the idea of the novel, as you said earlier, a woman buys a gun, but there's the other half, which is a woman falls in love with a horse and buys a gun. That came very quickly. But the characters, from what I read, it sounds like they took some time to find. How did you find Donald and Viv?
Thank you for asking. They did take some time. The gem or germ of the novel came from an acquaintance who actually had this happen to him. He was searching the trunk of his car and discovered a gun. When he asked his wife, she said, "Oh, yeah, yeah, I just forgot to tell you." And he was taken aback in a very complicated way.
Now, that's the start of a story right there.
Yes, exactly. But then I had to think, you know, part of what I was interested in exploring in Mercury was the way in which two people in a long relationship can grow apart. And thinking about maybe a different kind of infidelity or adultery. There are lots of novels, I think, about physical adultery. But what about if you meet someone and you share a certain body of beliefs, and then one person in the relationship really changes their mind about that, those beliefs, or some of them? How do you deal with that? And so I tried to think about a couple who could embody that situation, who would come together thinking of themselves as sharing a certain body of liberal beliefs and ideas and ideals about relationships. And unbeknownst to Donald, who remains a very upright Scottish person who just happens to live outside of Boston, Viv is really swept away by her passion for this horse, Mercury, and her sense that really her time to do what she dreams about doing, being a champion equestrian, is running out.
To me, they struck me as two people who made the inevitable compromises that life brings. One accepts those compromises, the other can't. And there's not a right or wrong to either one of those. It's just how they are. Was that what you were thinking with the two characters?
That was very much what I was thinking, Rich. And in addition, I was writing this in the years leading up to the 2016 election. I was also really interested in the question of ambition in women and how we regard ambitious women. And somehow ambition still seems more acceptable in men than in women. And so a woman like Viv, who doesn't want to keep putting her children first, who really wants to pursue this dream of being a great rider, we tend to judge her rather harshly. And I think that's really interesting.
I was really struck by the reaction reviewers and readers have had to these two characters. There's no middle ground, I think. Even the New York Times, it totally sides with Donald. Another reviewer, the Boston Globe, sides with Viv. And you see that in the reaction to the novel. There's not seeing ambiguity in these two characters. You identify with one or the other.
And of course, I find that very interesting that it does polarize readers. I wanted the characters to be like people we might know in our own lives whom we disagree about and argue about.
Donald is a very interesting character. We think he's going to narrate all the way through, but all of a sudden Viv takes over at one point. But Donald is a man who has made a lot of compromises and just sort of rolled with the flow, said this is life. And in many ways, changed for the worse because of it, I think. And he's also a person who's always, when conflict comes up, goes the other way, I think. He's a surgeon.
That's a very nice way of putting it.
Yeah, he's a surgeon who settles for being an ophthalmologist, who eventually settles for becoming an optometrist. Viv, on the other hand, loved riding younger as a young person, sort of decided to go into finance, was somewhat successful, but it was not something she was proud of. She longed for this to be something more than what she was going to be, and found it when she went back to riding.
Yes, and I think you know, the world of riding is a very passionate world. I really kind of only grazed the outskirts, but that's a mixed metaphor. I only kind of glimpsed the outskirts doing my research at various stables around Boston. But people who love horses feel very, very strongly about them. And the horse has a very long relationship with humans. So that also, I think, plays into the passion people bring to bear. And I think a character like Donald, I mean, what he what he values is his family life. He keeps putting that first, his father's health, his children, his greater family's well-being. And there are very good things about that, but he's also, maybe we would say, not very perceptive about the people around him.
And I love the choice you made to make him an optometrist, a man whose whole reason for his professional life is to help people see, and yet he can't see much around him.
I know. I mean, of course, that just happened as I worked on the novel. And I'm always struck when I visit an optometrist, those endless questions, better or worse, one or two. And I was very tempted to use those in the novel.
Now, so let me ask you, because that device right there, an optometrist who helps others to see but can't see, and worries when his patient's eyesight are failing or going blind in the case of a friend, and yet can't see what's around him. In many ways, that sounds like it's kind of a very trite device. Was that something that came naturally and you only recognized it later, or was that something you definitely wanted to explore from the very beginning?
Well, I was anxious that it could too easily become symbolical, and I did try to work quite hard to make clear that, you know, this is Donald's chosen line of work, his profession, and you know, we need to see it first and foremost as the way he makes a living. And if there is some symbolical aspect to that, so be it.
The other question I had was about how the novel unfolds as who's telling us the story. We begin with Donald. We end with Donald. But in the middle, Viv takes over. What led to that decision?
I had originally thought that the whole novel would be Donald's, that it would be his story he was telling. And then at a certain point, Viv was just behaving so badly from Donald's point of view that I felt it would be shortchanging both her and the reader if I didn't show what motivated her, and that we really had to understand why she was making these choices. I mean, some of the choices are purposeful, and then some of the major things are, of course, accidents that come about because of those choices. But it felt that without her point of view, the novel would not be satisfactory.
And the idea that both of these people have made compromises, and the idea that neither are necessarily right or wrong in how they reacted to those compromises wouldn't be possible if Donald told this whole story, right?
Exactly. We would not understand the steps that led Viv to, you know, buy a gun secretly, and then, as I don't think this is a spoiler, then unfortunately using it.
Yes. Well, when you buy a gun, eventually you're going to use it, right?
that does seem to be the unfortunate logic.
At least in fiction.
Yes, exactly.
Now, I understand that that story that you said, and I assume that sort of sparked this book, the idea that you heard of a friend who said, yeah, I'm, you know, I discovered my wife bought a gun and didn't tell me. That's spurred a bit of work, hasn't it? You actually decided to investigate this for yourself.
I did, and that was the other thing that prompted me to write Mercury. I wrote a column for the Boston Globe about what it was like to buy a gun in Massachusetts, or in Cambridge, Massachusetts, to be precise, seeing the rules differ from place to place. And when I published the column, I got about 120 emails, of which I would say 118 took me to task. And I also got phone messages on my home telephone, half a dozen of them, all from men, and all of them saying something to the effect, like, you're just some Scottish immigrant. You're lucky there are armed Americans ready to take care of you. Words to that effect. So I realized I had really hit a nerve. And of course, that was extremely interesting. I wanted to explore that further.
I would assume as a native Scot, you had no idea how to purchase a gun when you began trying to...
I, abs- I absolutely didn't. And I'm pleased to say that it's extremely difficult. But I did end up taking a gun safety course. And the person who taught the gun safety course gave me an insight into that other world where the choice isn't really whether to buy a gun. The choice is more why wouldn't you have a gun, where it's really just very much taken for granted. And when I was doing research for Mercury, I visited a number of gun shops in New Hampshire where people were extremely helpful in just talking to me about, you know, when they'd bought their first gun, why they had a gun, all those questions.
I want to ask you I just popped into my head this idea that, is this the first book in which you've had a gun being used in the course of your book?
I'm pleased to say it has. My novels have been singularly free of that kind of violence, although several of them have other kinds of violence.
Did you find it was necessary to actually fire a gun to be able to write about it?
For me, it was. And it was interesting. I mean, I think one of the things about guns is they're quite a sort of sexy subject. People are really interested in talking about guns, and almost everyone has a gun story or two. So my coach, the person who gave me the gun safety, taught me the gun safety course, took me to a range and gave me various guns to fire.
Hmm. What was your own reaction to firing it? Was it horror, or was there some fascination there?
I would say there was definite fascination and also dismay at how incredibly easy it was to do. You know, what a very small gesture it was to pull a trigger, really. It was disturbing to discover, and I was firing a gun that had a clip of, I think, 15 bullets, and you know, it was so easy just to fire those 15 bullets.
Well, it's a really interesting novel. Mercury is the name of the novel. The most recent book is The Hidden Machinery, Essays on Writing. You'll be hearing at least a portion of The Hidden Machinery in her presentations at Nimrod's Conference for Readers and Writers this Saturday. Margot Livesey, thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you so much, Rich.
Nimrod Literary Award fiction judge Margot Livesey speaking with us here on Studio Tulsa. Her most recent novel is titled Mercury. Her most recent book, a book of essays on writing, is titled The Hidden Machinery. She'll be featured in the Nimrod Conference for Readers and Writers this Saturday at the University of Tulsa and also at the Nimrod Write Night, Friday evening at 6:30 at the Tulsa Historical Society. That event is free to the public. Information at utulsa.edu/Nimrod. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.